I believe this program can work for me too. Joey?
Thanks, Bob.
Hey, I'm Joey. I'm an alcoholic. The speaker tonight is my sister, and she got sober about 2 years before I did. She's been a huge part of my sobriety. If she sponsored you, you know she's a hard ass. She has really kind of given me an idea of what kind of a man I want to be, you know, because I've been so close to her, and I'm such good friends with her, and she's just awesome, and it's a treat that she's here. So here's Lacey.
Hi, y'all. I'm Lacey. I'm an alcoholic. I'm nervous. All right, I'm so grateful to be here. Thank you, Bob and Joey, for asking me to speak. It's always an honor and a privilege when asked to be of service to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd like to thank my home group members that came out to support me. Thanks, y'all. It's great to have y'all here. My sobriety date is May 28th, 2010. I have a home group. It is for the Fun of It group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Buford, Georgia. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor who has a sponsor. I have the honor and privilege of sponsoring women, and I'm so grateful for that. My story does involve drugs, and I touch on the drug part because for me it's where my alcoholism brought me. When I was first getting sober, I just didn't really know if I was an alcoholic. I didn't know if AA was for me. I thought that I had like bigger issues, drugs and all that other stuff. But for me, I know today that, you know, that's just where my alcoholism took me. So I will touch on it. I was born in Atlanta, Georgia. I have a younger brother. My parents got divorced. I think I was around 8 years old or something like that. And I remember my mom moved us out to Tucker, Georgia, because I guess she believed that the schooling would be better, or like our outcome would somehow like be better than it was. And that really wasn't the case. At the age of 14, I got in trouble for running away from home. I remember starting a fight with my mom on purpose. She like asked me to clean the ferret's cage or something, and I was like, no, I'm not cleaning the ferret's cage. And I remember I ran away at the age of 14 with some dude, and they called the police, and I got arrested and went to DeKalb County Jail at the age of 14, and I thought I was in hell. And it really was just a huge eye-opener. I remember waking up. I hadn't slept in a couple of days just because I wasn't even like using at the time. And I woke up at Charter Peachford, and I wasn't even into drugs and alcohol heavy at that time, but I was just kind of crazy. I was always just kind of off, like had behavioral problems, didn't fit in, never felt, just had a lot of fear, all that stuff. And I remember going to Charter Peachford, and you have to do like that closeout thing with your family. I don't even remember what it was exactly. It was a long time ago. And somebody told me about Atlanta Insight. I don't know if y'all have ever heard of that place, but what I knew of Atlanta Insight was that I could stay up all night, hang out with people my age, and like chain smoke. And I was like, that sounds badass. Like, I'm going to go home. I was like, I'm going to go home and get grounded, and that's going to suck. Like, I don't want to do that. So I went to Atlanta Insight. I was there. I got there, I think, when I was 15. And they came at me with the steps and the disease thing. And I was like, dude, whatever, that's lame or something like that. And I didn't honestly know anything about, you know, the disease or drinking or using. I had tried like a beer before or a joint or something. But I definitely left Atlanta Insight with more knowledge of drugs and alcohol. I left when I was 16 and started using acid a lot and ecstasy. And that didn't work out very well. And I went back to Atlanta Insight. I believe I was 16. I was 16 and stayed. I had 2 years sober, I guess, just through the fellowship and hanging out with people. And I left again when I was 18. And again, got introduced to harder drugs. And that was when I used meth for the first time and heroin. And I remember living in this apartment, and the people that I was hanging out with were, I don't know, they got into heroin and stuff like that. And again, I say that I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I totally respect the traditions and respect its primary purpose. But for me, it was just really important in the beginning to identify, and I didn't identify with the alcoholism thing at first. But anyways, and got introduced to those harder drugs, and I was always in relationships. Alcohol and drugs and all that was not enough to fill that God-sized hole in my soul. And so I was in a relationship always, and I was with this guy. We were together, I guess, for 2 years or something like that. I met him in Insight, and we, like, bailed together. And we started hanging out, and how long was it? I think we were out of there for about a year or something like that, and life was just still shit. And he decided to join the military. And he left and went to boot camp for 3 months, and I was like, oh, shit, you know, like, my security is all gone. Like, what do I do? Like, I just felt empty on the inside. And I remember, I'm going to bring it back to high school really fast. I went to Tucker High School for, I think, till about 10th grade. I dropped out in 10th grade. High school was not a good experience for me. I was not pretty. I was not popular. I didn't like people. They didn't like me. I was fearful. I was not comfortable in my own skin. But my brother was Mr. Social. He somehow, like, had those skills. Like, he was popular, wore, like, Ralph Lauren. And and I did not. Like, I had, like, bright red hair and wore, like, Adidas t-shirts with a Nike ring. Like, I was not a pretty sight. I had, like, I don't know, it was just bad. And so I remember my brother always throwing, like, these big keg parties at my mom's, and I was, like, that weird older sister that, like, hung out in my room with the door closed on the phone while my brother and all his, like, really cool friends threw keg parties, and I was, like, pissed off about it, or tried to clean up the beer cans, I don't remember. And then I had this thought one night. I was like, well, why don't I join them? Like, what are they doing out there? And I remember they had this vanilla Bacardi with grenadine and pineapple juice. And I was like, ooh, that sounds good. And I remember drinking it, and I wasn't afraid anymore. I wasn't afraid of y'all. I didn't feel insecure. I felt like I had courage. Like, I could talk to people. You guys could talk to me. I felt pretty. All that stuff. And for me, even when I started using acid and ecstasy, that feeling of self-hate, that feeling of fear, of being afraid of people, of being afraid of the world, of being afraid of life, acid and ecstasy didn't make that go away. If anything, it totally intensified it. They say that, you know, if you're an overthinker and you trip, holy shit, you're gonna think so much more, and I did, and that was bad. And so anyways, when I took my first sip of alcohol, or the first one that basically comes to my mind, all those really deep-seated fears, they went away, and I felt cool. And I remember drinking so much, I got, like, dizzy or something, and I was, like, walking back to my room, and I could hardly walk. And I was like, okay, I just have to make it to my room, and then fell on the ground. And I remember saying to myself, I was like, Lacey, get up. Get up and go back out there and hang out. And I did. And so I started hanging out in bars. We started hanging out at this really classy bar called The Last Great Watering Hole. Like, that's what it was called. And it was rough, dude. It was rough. And we started playing poker, and I just got introduced to this really rough crowd. And I got introduced to cocaine. And for me, drinking and cocaine went hand in hand. I wasn't really buying the cocaine first. I was drinking, and I always, once I got drunk, got a little sleepy. And I didn't want to be sleepy because I wanted to drink more. And as soon as I snorted cocaine, I was good, off to the races, like it talks about, and could continue to drink and could continue to stay up. And for me, it just kind of got out of hand that way. Every time I drank, cocaine went along with it every single time. And it got to the point where I didn't need the alcohol to buy it. I knew that I was going to drink, and I knew that I would need to have it in order for the night to be good. And then you need the crap that you have to come down off of it, and it was just bad. And I remember meeting this other guy, and it was a very abusive relationship, and I was definitely one of those girls that was raised to never, ever, ever, ever put up with disrespect from men. I would never, ever let a guy hit me. I was definitely one of those girls that was like, I will never tolerate that. I will never put up with it. And it was just definitely kind of a yet for me because it did happen. And I remember the first time I ever got hit in the face by a dude, and I never thought that would happen. I was like up drinking all night. My brother was passed out on the couch, and I remember he hit me, and I was like, I'm gonna go tell my brother. And I didn't go tell my brother because he was passed out drunk like we all were. And I knew that if I did and he did something about it, then I might have to change my behavior and not be with the dude anymore. And I stayed with him for 3 years, and we drank, and it was very, very violent. And I never thought that I would ever stay in a relationship like that for that long. And I remember one of my lowest points, or it felt like one of my lowest points. I wasn't even close to sobriety. But I remember him dragging me upstairs by my hair and then like throwing me outside, and I could have left. I could have like gone home, and I chose to stay. And I remember waking up the next morning there, and I was like, is this really what my life has come to? Like, is this, do I really hate myself this much to put up with this shit? Like, is this really what my life is gonna amount to? And I, you know, stayed with him for a while. And for me, I just didn't know any better. I just didn't know how to leave it. And I didn't know how to get out of the chaos. And I could drink the way I wanted to, and I could live the way I wanted to, which was not fun. But it was just kind of crazy. Like, we would get in this crazy fight, and then we would break up, and I would go drink and snort cocaine for a few days and feel like shit. And I needed a way to feel better, and I went to guys for that. And so I lived that way for, like I said, 3 years. And I remember I never felt like I wanted to be something when I grew up. I never wanted to be like a firefighter or a nurse or anything like that. Like, I just never had this ambition to want to be something. And the only purpose I really felt like I had was to get drunk. I didn't feel comfortable in my own skin. I didn't feel comfortable around y'all, around people, unless I was high or drunk. And I remember I ended up getting pregnant, and I never ever thought in a million years that I would get pregnant. And let alone did I really even want to. I was in no condition to take care of a child. But I also had that feeling of like, maybe I will stop living the way that I'm living. Maybe I will stop drinking and stop using and have a purpose to life. Maybe she will give me that purpose. And she didn't. I ended up having her, and her dad, she's never met her dad or whatever he is, and thank God for that. And I remember even after I was pregnant, I ended up leaving him. I got sober for a little bit just due to the pregnancy, and I guess I got a little clear-headed. And I remember he said to me, how are you gonna take care of me and a baby? And I was like, I'm done, like I'm so done with this. And so for me, using people to fill that void, or using people to feel good, again, if you don't have a solution to that, you're going to kind of keep using the same tools. And for me, that's what I did. I went from one relationship to another relationship. And for me, another symptom of my alcoholism was I got married, and that was crazy. It was crazy. I knew the guy for like 2 weeks, and I was like 7 months pregnant, dude. And it was not pretty. And he thought I was pretty. And I was like, yes. Like 7 months pregnant, like just bad self-hatred, like rough. And God, it was bad. And I remember the night before I got married, we were hanging out in a bar, and I'm like wearing a tube top, pregnant, like just shitty. And I remember he got really mad at me because he thought I was drinking. Like, I think I might have been, honestly. I did. And that was another thing that was really hard for me, actually. But I did drink when I was pregnant, and I didn't understand why I drank. I thought that I was just a piece of shit. Who does that? What type of person drinks while they're pregnant? And I did. And, you know, I had no solution to life. I had no solution to feel good. I was still irritable, restless, and discontented, pregnant. And I remember getting an email from some baby website, and they were like, you are now in your second trimester, help yourself to a red glass of wine. And I was like, do you know, you just okayed for me. Like a bottle later, like purple teeth, like it was bad. And I remember waking up the next morning, and I was just like, I hope my child is alive. Like, I hope that she's okay. I didn't understand why I had just done what I did. I understand it today, thank God, but I didn't know then. And so I had her, and I was married to this guy, and he was there popping pain pills in the hospital the whole time, and I had no idea. I should have, but I had no idea. And I remember him and my brother had just gotten back from Iraq, and they were just kind of big into pills. And I was like, what is the deal with these opiates? Like, why are they so popular? They had, like, bags of them and shit. And I was like, I didn't know what was the big deal about it. And then after I had my daughter, they gave me pain pills in the hospital, and I found out why they were so great. And I remember the nurse coming in, and they were talking to me about, like, postpartum depression. They were like, you should probably see somebody for postpartum depression. I was like, no, I'm good. Like, I don't struggle with depression at all. And and I actually had it really, really bad. It was really, really, really bad. And right after I had my little girl, I moved down to an army base and, like, lived in the army barracks, and that's crazy. That is not a place for women or children at all. And it was really rough. And I remember the only way that I could really cope with it, the only way that I knew to deal with what I was feeling and to live the way that I was living was to get high and to drink. And it was just too scary, the thought of, like, changing my life and leaving this guy that I was with that I didn't even like. All of the guys I have been with in my life, I haven't liked. I haven't respected. It's just another thing that I needed to feel okay. Drinking and drugs weren't enough. I can also use people to try and fill that void. And so anyways, I was living down at Fort Stewart. I know, dude, it's bad. And it was like the hellhole of Georgia, probably. And I definitely, again, did things that I never, ever thought I would ever do. I guess I thought that I could beat certain drugs or certain substances because I had a really good childhood. And I know that, you know, my childhood has nothing to do with me being an alcoholic. It just kind of works out that way. And I remember living down at Fort Stewart, and we got our tax return back or something like that. And it was like $3,000, which was like, holy shit, a lot of money for me. And it was gone in like a week. We spent it on pills. And I remember I was drunk one night. And of course, whenever I drank, I did cocaine. Guaranteed, always did. And the cocaine ran out. And my daughter was going to wake up that morning. And I knew that if I was going to take care of her, I'd have to be awake. And so the only thing else I knew to get was crack. And I never thought ever, y'all, that I would ever do that, ever. I was better than that, or I don't even know. And and I remember doing that, and I remember this rough memory. When I was in treatment, I think the pain of the mommy guilt I felt is definitely what brought me to the gift of desperation and surrendering. I remember being up for a few days and needing more drugs, and the places that we go to get what we need. And for me, I needed that stuff to survive. I needed it to live. I needed it to feel okay. And I remember I had my little girl. She was like 3 months old. I took her to a crack dealer's house, and she was just in there with me. And I left her in there with the crack dealer while I went and smoked it. It's what I had to do. It was the only tool that I had to know how to be a parent. I had no idea what I was doing. I was a child with a child. I was selfish and self-centered to the extreme and had no idea how to put anybody before myself. I had no idea how to do that. And but it hurt. It was very painful. And I don't know, I loved her. I do still. And I would have died for her. It's so hard to feel like you would die for somebody, but at the same time, you're like, just get away from me. I love you. I love you. Just go away. I love you. Go away. I didn't know how to give her what she needed. And that, again, just kind of added to the self-hate that I already had. And so I remember the guy that I was married to, he got out of the Army for drugs, and he got kicked out or something like that. And we moved back up to Atlanta, and we attempted to live with my mom for a little bit, but that didn't work out. We ended up, like, stealing money from her and getting kicked out. And the only people we could really find to live with were, like, weird ads on Craigslist. And God, and this whole time I'm taking my child with me. And it was just hell. And so I remember moving in with this lady and her husband. And it was so strange. They were rich. They had a big house, and it was pretty. And so I remember the first thing that we did was go raid their bathroom to see what they might have. And they had a lot of stuff. And we took it all in like 3 days. And I think that was a little bit of a red flag to them. And and I remember we stole their jewelry and watches and pawned it to pawn shops. And I remember Easter of 2010 waking up to the cops, or I heard a knock on my door, and I was like, yeah, I just come in. I just thought it was the people that I was living with, and it was Gwinnett County. And I was like, oh, shit. And so we went downstairs, and my daughter was down there with the police and the people that live there, and it was horrible, horrible. Talk about it, incomprehensible demoralization. I always wore long sleeves. something that I meant to touch on too. I got into opiates really bad, and I started like crushing them up like 10 Lore tabs and putting them in Coca-Cola and then like drinking it, thinking it would like hit me faster. And started snorting Roxy's and Oxycontin and all that stuff. And I was again one of those people that would never use needles. Only real junkies use needles, and I'm not. You know, you real messed up people do that. I don't. And I did. And I did for a while. And I never ever again thought I would ever do that. And I remember going downstairs to those people's house, and the cops were down there, and they were accusing us of stealing their stuff. And I was like, no, I didn't steal it. I swear. Like, go upstairs and look through my stuff. And they're like, okay. Like, we'll go look through your stuff. And I had on long sleeves, and the first thing the lady said to me was, show me your arms. And I was like, I'm screwed. Like, she caught me. And I was like, I kind of got to get honest about something. And I told her that I had a problem with drugs, and she was like, you know, how long have you been doing that? And I don't even remember what I said. And she was like, you can continue to live here if you go to treatment or if you go to detox. And in Gwinnett County, in order to get into a detox center, you have to be suicidal or homicidal. And so I went to Gwinnett County, Gwinnett Medical Center, and said that I was suicidal. I wasn't. And so I went to detox for the first time. Holy crap. I went to detox for the first time. And that was rough. And I lost custody of my daughter. And you know what? Honestly, I was glad. And I hated myself for being glad. Because I was finally like, I can drink and use the way that I want, and I won't have to worry about her life. It's still today, by the grace of God, that my daughter never died and that I never did. There were many nights where I could hardly drive, and she was in the back seat, and I remember just praying, which I didn't do, and just praying that God would make me, that would get us home safe, and she's alive and well today. And anyways, went to detox. And for the first time, and I started, we lived in a hotel, and again, I never thought that I would live in a hotel room, and we started going to a methadone clinic, which was crap, and the only way that we could afford to pay the hotel night thing was like 30 bucks or something, was to beg for money in parking lots. I didn't have a job, he didn't have a job, and I never thought I'd be begging for money in parking lots, and we did that, and it was awful. And I remember waking up lots of mornings. It was weird. I got to see my daughter on the weekends because my mom had her. And I kind of faked the whole like methadone thing for a while. I was like, see, I'm not high. It's like legal. So it's okay. And I kind of believed it. But I guess I had to believe it to continue doing what I was doing. But I remember waking up before I'd go to the methadone clinic every morning. And I could hardly breathe with the pain that I felt and the guilt that I felt. And then I remember my mom was like, you're gonna get arrested. And I was like, no, I'm not. I'm not gonna go to jail. And I did. I remember I was on a lot of methadone. I think I was on like 90 milligrams at the time. And I loved to shoplift, y'all. When I was high or drunk, I don't know why. I loved to steal. I guess I felt like empowered. And I remember when I got a felony, I was shoplifting at Macy's. God. And I thought I was so good at it, and I wasn't. And the most painful part was my daughter was with me. And I remember getting caught. And I kind of thought about running. But I thought, I was like, if I run, I'm going to leave my daughter, and I'm not going to do that. And so I remember being in the back of Macy's. I didn't even know what to feel. I couldn't even accept what was happening and having my little girl with me. I don't even know if she was one yet. And she was just crying, and I couldn't even take care of her. I couldn't even hold her or make her feel better because I was a baby that was crying too. And I remember I had like 13 Benadryl in my wallet for some reason. I don't know why I had random amounts of Benadryl. And so I was like, if I'm going to jail, I'm going to go to sleep. Like, I'm not going to be awake in jail. Jail sucks. And so I took all the Benadryl. And I remember talking to my mom, and I told her that I took it. And she, like, freaked out and was like, you need to go to the hospital. And I remember telling the cop. I don't even remember what he said, but I remember leaving Macy's in an ambulance, going to the hospital, and they were like, you know, as soon as you get out, you need to turn yourself in. And I was like, yeah, okay. And so right from Gwinnett Medical, I went to detox again. And right out of detox, I did have a warrant out for my arrest. I remember right out of detox, I pawned the wedding ring I bought myself for $50 and bought an Oxycontin with it, straight out of detox. And had a warrant out for my arrest, and I remember the guy that I was married to at the time, he was like, you gotta turn yourself back in. He bonded me out on a promise to pay the bond. I don't know how the hell he got away with that. I have no idea. But if you have two drunks together and they have any money, it is not going to be to do the next right thing. And we didn't. And I remember living in that hotel again, and God, that was awful. And I remember I was going to work and I heard a knock on the door and it was a cop. And I was like, oh shit. And I went and hid in the bathroom. And the cop was like shooting the shit with my ex or whatever. And I was like, we're cool. Like, they're just hanging out. And so I walk out and arrested on the spot and went to jail. And I remember I was coming, I was detoxing off methadone. And that's awful. Talk about death. God, that's what it felt like. And so that's when he bonded me out on a promise to pay the bond with, like, my car title or something. And so I got out, and we tried to get it from my dad, but he was like, I'm not giving you that. And so I remember my ex-husband was like, you got to turn yourself back in. Like, you got to go back to jail. And I was like, uh-uh. Like, I'm not ever going back to jail. But I was facing jail time. And I was at work one day. I was a server at, like, the Twisted Taco or something. And I got a call from a bounty hunter, and he was like, I'm gonna put more warrants out on you and your husband if you don't turn yourself in. And his name was Mickey, and it was like straight up like Dog the Bounty Hunter. This dude was huge. He was like 6'4", huge guy. And he was like, I don't know how he kind of pulled it out in me, but I just broke down and started crying, and my mom was done with me, and he was like, would you be willing to go out to eat with your mom and I? And I was like, oh my God, like, sure. And so I went out to eat with them, and he was just like, I will try and keep you out of jail if you're willing to go to treatment. And I like poured my heart out to him about the things that I'd been doing. And I was just done. I was just done. And I went out to eat with him and my mom at like Applebee's off Pleasant Hill. God, I remember it. And he was like, I don't know, you know, if I can keep you out of jail, but I will try. And I remember being willing to go to rehab. And it wasn't even it was totally because of what was happening. But I knew that I needed help for a really long time. I was just too afraid to ask for it. Or I was too afraid to always leave these relationships I was in that were horrible. But it was that mommy guilt, I tell you. It was awful. And it was kind of like I felt like, I don't know, like my heart was missing. I can't even explain it. I never felt anything like it in my life. I had the desire to be a parent, but I didn't think I would be good at it. I was like, I'm not gonna be good at it. It was like all the other things in my life that I knew that I wasn't gonna be good at, so why even try? Why even try just to fail? Like, I knew that I would fail. And I went to treatment, and I remember picking the treatment center place out. There was like a list of rehabs, and it said the Bridges of Hope. And the word hope stuck out to me because I had none. And I was like, hope, okay, like I'm going there. And I really thought it was going to be like a lay in bed type deal. Like, feel sorry for me. I'm coming off drugs. Like, my life has been so bad and I don't know how. And it just was not that. I did not ever like to work. I didn't like to work hard. I didn't like to sweat. I didn't like to do any of that shit. And when I went to treatment, and I had to scrub toilets and scrub showers and like plant food. And I remember we had to go out to like pea fields, and they were like, we're gonna shuck corn and shell peas. I was like, excuse me? Like, I'm from Atlanta. Like, I didn't even know what that meant. And y'all, it was just really crazy. I remember we were going out to some pea field, and they were like, is anybody allergic to bees? I was like, yes. I was like, I'm allergic to bees. And they turned the whole van around and like went back to my treatment center. And today I'm like, damn, do I need to get honest about not being allergic to bees? But I'm not going to. So anyways, I remember being in that treatment center, and they came at me with the big book. And I was like, oh, God, you know, here they come at me again with this AA stuff. I saw God on the walls. I saw the steps. I didn't want to hear it. I wasn't an alcoholic. I had bigger problems. I was manic depressive. I might have been bipolar. I am seriously depressed. I've been in all these really traumatic relationships. I'm different. I'm unique. I'm more screwed up than y'all drunks. But I really had no idea what I was talking about. And I thought it was just kind of cool to say that I was an alcoholic. Like, yeah, I drink a lot. I'm an alcoholic. I drink a lot. I had no idea that I suffered from alcoholism or what alcoholism even was. And for me, I didn't want to read the big book. I didn't know what reading had to do with getting sober. I didn't know what a book had to do with getting sober. I didn't want to read. I never liked to read. I didn't do well in school because of that. And I don't know what in the world. I don't know how I read the big book. I don't know how I had some desire to want to read it. I remember having to sit in like 3 days, 8 hours for 3 days at a time, several times in treatment. So I kind of had to read the big book. But I don't know how or why it stuck. I don't know how or why I remembered it. I don't know how I identified, but I'm so grateful for reading the doctor's opinion. And I remember when they came at me with a disease, I was like, don't come at me with that. Like, it's such a cop-out. I'm just a piece of shit. I just drink and I hurt people. It's just what I do. It's just who I am. It's just the way that I was made. And I was like, drinking seriously is not that big of a deal. And I remember reading that part in the big book where it says, to drink is to die. And I was like, that's so dramatic. Like, I can drink a Corona, it's not gonna kill me. But for me, I just really had to play the tape out. Did I just drink a beer? No, I always drank 12 packs and bottles and shots and bags of cocaine on top of lots of Xanax. And how I never died, I have no idea. I had lots of friends that did. And so anyways, I remember reading the big book, and I remember that part on page 30 where it says we had to concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. And that is the first step in recovery. And for me, it just really took reading the doctor's opinion and really just kind of backtracking my life when I did step one and had to write out my drug and alcohol history and just seeing the way that I felt most of my life and how I wasn't ever normal. I wasn't normal. I didn't handle things normally. I didn't feel things normally. I was just socially awkward, fearful, afraid of the world, and I had a massive amount of self-hate. And it really was, for me, to drink is to die. For me to go back out there is to die. It was either work the steps, or it says choose a spiritual program or go out blotting to the bitter end or something like that. And I was like, damn. And they talk about how those options kind of both suck. I was not down with God. I didn't want to hear about it. I was not brought up in a home where we talked about that. I remember my dad coming to visit me in treatment, and he was like, don't you leave here a Christian. Because I said, like, by the grace of God, I never got a DUI. Got a felony, but never got a DUI. And he was like, don't you leave here a Christian. And I was like, thanks. Okay, won't leave here a Christian. And I remember the manager in my treatment center saying to me, do you believe that I believe? And I believed that God could work in her life. And I believed that God, you know, helped her get sober. And she was like, well, just hold on to that. And I had so many cheesy ass moments in treatment. Like, I remember someone saying to me, pray for God to reveal himself to you. And I was like, that's going to work. And I did. And that acronym, FROG, fully relying on God. God, this story is really lame, but I just knew it was a God thing. I was laying in bed. It was like a Sunday morning, and we got to sleep in until like 7 or something. And there was this frog. There were lots of frogs down south, and I remember this really loud, I don't even know what kind it was, I thought it was a bullfrog. It was huge in my head, and it wouldn't shut up, and it was croaking and croaking, and I was just laying there pissed off, like wanting to go to sleep, and finally the thought popped in my head, like, why don't you pray about it? Like, why don't you ask God to get this frog to shut up? And I was like, really? And I did, and it stopped right then and there. It didn't make another noise, and it never did. Didn't come back. And I was like, okay, that's really weird. And still to this day, of course, when I say that, I'm like, it just seems so small. But for me, the little things that happen with God today, I can feel them in my heart, and that's what matters. And I remember being in treatment, and it was a 6-month inpatient place. And I remember laying in bed and just having lots of remorse come back to me. And I just remember feeling the pain. And I don't ever, ever want to get sober ever again. I don't ever want to go through that. It was the hardest thing I've ever had to do. And I hear people say getting sober is not for, I'm not going to say that word, but it's not easy. And it wasn't for me. And it was really hard. And I remember my little girl coming to see me in treatment. And I remember seeing her, I was 25 when I went to treatment. I turned 26 at like 30 days sober. Or something like that. I remember seeing my little girl, and she was walking with my mom, and she said the word tree. And I was like, holy shit, you can say tree. And it was so cute. And I got out of treatment. It was 6 months, and I went home. And they were like, go to meetings, get a sponsor, and find a home group. And I was like, I'm doing that. And I found For the Fun of It group. For the Fun of It group, it is a clubhouse. They have meetings every day. We have like 20 meetings a week or something like that. And it's what I needed. They said, for me, it was kind of like, how willing are you? Are you willing to go to any lengths? And I remember living down in Hinesville, Georgia, driving 4 hours in the snow, meeting a drug dealer, driving 4 hours back. So for me today, when I'm tired or like have a headache or don't feel good, I remember that day. Would I go to a bar if I was tired? Would I call a drug dealer if I had a headache? You bet your ass, I would do those things. So for me today, I go to meetings if I'm tired. I go to meetings if I have a headache. And it's kept me sober today. And I remember getting a sponsor, and she was a badass. And I remember the first sponsor I had, I needed a sponsor that could see through my shit, because I'm a master manipulator, I tell you. And this first sponsor I had, I could manipulate her, and I knew it. And I needed somebody that would know when I was trying to manipulate them. And this person, my sponsor today, does. Still knows when I'm full of shit. And I'm so grateful for that, because it saved my life. And she loved me enough to tell me the brutal, honest truth. I had had things sugarcoated for me my whole life. I'd been babied my whole life. I actually remember when I was in treatment, I lied. I got in trouble at 5 months out of 6 months. 5 months sober, I finally get in trouble, and I'm about to, like, graduate or whatever. And I lied about something. Some chick got a pass, and I told her, or I don't even really remember, but the part that I got in trouble with was when they confronted me with it, I didn't tell them the truth. And I remember the manager in my treatment center, and I was crying, and she was like, don't come in here with those crocodile tears trying to manipulate me and get your way. And I was like, like, how dare you talk to me that way? And I'm so grateful for that woman. She was so hard on me, and I am so grateful. She probably really wasn't. I just probably took it that way. But it really saved my life. And I found God digging in a garden in a thing of pine straw, sweating with bugs and bees, and I did not like that. But it saved my life. And for me, still in sobriety, it's the hardest things that saved my life. Doing the things I don't want to do. Talking about the things I don't want to talk about. And for me, this program is definitely about actions. I think a lot of bad stuff. I feel a lot of shit that isn't real. And for me today, it's just doing it anyways. It doesn't matter what I feel. It doesn't matter what I think. That's irrelevant. It's what I do with my feet. It's what my actions are doing. And for me, that's just still what I continue to do today. And I remember getting my sponsor and starting the steps and doing things sober that I never thought I could do. I went to hair school. I always kind of wanted to do hair and makeup. It was just kind of like my thing. But again, it was just one of those things I didn't think I'd be good at. So why even try? But then I was like, who can't hold a blow dryer and scissors? I think I can do that. But God, that shit is hard. Hair school is a lot harder than I thought it would be. And I had like 10 months sober. And I wish I would have done school a little bit differently today, but whatever. And it was really hard. And I remember like leaving school on the clock, and that is so dishonest. That was so dishonest of me, but I did it. School sucked, it always did. But I graduated. I have no idea how I graduated, and I passed state board with no scissors. I had no shears, none. I had to do the haircut with the razor, and that was rough. But for me, again, that was just another God thing. I graduated state board for cosmetology with no scissors. And I did that, and I learned how to grow up in AA. I was a child, trying to raise a child. For me, the 12 steps is just maturity, learning to grow the fuck up. And I wasn't grown. My thinking was immature. It still is. My attitude can be immature. My feelings can be immature. And just really learning to grow up and to be the woman that God created me to be, to learn to be the parent God created me to be. My first year sober, I did a lot of fellowshipping, hanging out with the young kids, like trying to run from being a parent. Like it wasn't cool. Like I still was trying to be cool or impress something like I was in high school. Like that's not what life is about. And I forget that. And I still can today. I can forget that. It's not about impressing people or being cool because I want everybody to like me. You know what I mean? Like, that's what I struggle with. I want to be approved and liked by everybody. I may not like you, but you still need to like me. And for me, that it's just been hard, but it's just better today. And I'm a parent. I have my daughter back, and she's beautiful and amazing. And for me, like I said, my first year sober, I did a lot of fellowshipping, and it was very hard learning to be a parent and learning to have love and tolerance and having the desire to want to do that, I didn't really. I loved her and would have given my life for her, but still wanting to give up my selfish ways, because for me, there is nothing really selfish about parenting. It is so hard. It is so hard, and especially trying to stay sober and learn how to be a mom at the same time. It was definitely challenging for me, but I kept wanting to know what my purpose was. Why did God create me? What am I here to do? And for me, it was in front of me all along. Like, for me, having a child is the most beautiful thing that you can experience. It's unconditional love, and I remember always wanting to be somebody that would be unselfish in a relationship. I didn't want to suck the life out of people anymore, because it's what I do, and it's what I did. And I was like, I want to love somebody unselfishly. I had no idea what that meant, to love somebody unselfishly. I was in a relationship so you could make me feel better. And if you couldn't do that, then F off. And that's not fun. People don't like that. And for me, that's not what love is today. And learning how to be a mom and learning how to take care of my little girl and still putting what I want to do aside. And that's hard. And I have gritted my teeth through that. And it has been very hard. And my sponsor just telling me, why don't you sit at home and practice watching a movie and, like, drawing? And I was like, ugh, I don't want to sit and draw. Like, I don't even know how to. And she's like, get a coloring book and color and sit there and color a whole picture. And I was like, ugh, that does not sound fun. I want to, like, I don't even know what I wanted to go do. But I did that. And I did that with her. And it has been the most rewarding thing. And it doesn't feel good when you're a parent and you're a crappy one. That doesn't feel good. And for me, I didn't get sober to be miserable. I didn't get sober to not like myself. I didn't get sober to sit uncomfortably in my own skin, because that's why I got drunk. That's why I use drugs. And so for me, just really seeking out what God's will is for me, and that's not natural. It doesn't come naturally. It's something I have to practice doing, and I have to seek out and do. And I remember also coming to the realization, I will be 29 next month, at like 27 or 28, I can't remember which year it was, coming to the realization that it was not normal to be living off of your parents' credit card. And I had been my whole life. And when I was in hair school, my mom was like, here you go, like, you're sober, trying to do the right thing. But then I would bitch about her controlling me while I'm spending all of her money. And I didn't get it, like, it didn't line up. And then finally, thank God that it did. And I was like, oh, being self-supporting. I didn't know how to do that. But for me, I gained the most self-esteem and self-worth being self-supporting. I'm a single parent. I pay my rent. I pay my bills. And I live alone and take care of my daughter 6 days of the week, or something like that. And it is such an amazing feeling. it is such an amazing feeling, and it was just something I ran from. Like, God puts things in front of me, and I run from them because I got a lot of self in the way that I have to practice removing, and there's a lot of trial and error, and I have a lot of character defects, and I live in them often, but I have a daily reprieve, like the book talks about, that I get to wake up every day, and if I didn't like the way I behaved today, try and do better tomorrow. And Joey, you're funny. And I'm so grateful for that. And for me, you know, like I talked about the God thing, I didn't come into Alcoholics Anonymous down with God. I didn't want to hear about that shit at all. I was like smarter than that or above that or something like that. And I love that line in the book where it talks about we laugh at people that think they're too intellectually or something for God or whatever. And I was one of those people. And for me, also, this journey in this past year has just been really coming to know God in my heart and not just know God in my head. And for me, it's a very long journey from things to go from my head to my heart, and I'm so grateful that they have. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I want to talk about. And just being of service in my home group, and thank God for the women that I sponsor. They have no idea how amazing they are and how much they touch my life. I swear to God, every time I'm in a funk or in a lot of self, I get a phone call from one of them, ironically. And I remember my sponsor saying to me for so long, she's like, you have no idea, you know, the blessings you add to my life, or I'm helping you more than you help me. And I was like, whatever. Like, I have no idea how my crazy ass could be helping you at all. And I get it today, you know, I get it today. And I love the women that ask me to sponsor them, even when they think that I don't. I love them so much. And it's definitely one of those relationships where you love them unconditionally. There's nothing that they could do. If they're drunk or sober, you love them the same. And for me, I'm so grateful for that. And I'm grateful to be sober today. And there's just this one part I'm gonna close with. I have no idea what time it is. Okay, I have 10 minutes, so I can close early. But it's from the Big Book. It's on page 521 from Empty on the Inside, and it says, I still have a sponsor and a home group today. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing. I learned how to be a good AA member by watching good AA members and doing what they do. I learned how to have good relationships by watching people with good relationships and doing what they do. I learned how to be a parent by watching good parents and doing what they do. And I finally have the freedom of believing that it's all right not to know. But that's all I got. Thank you for having me.